Well, thank you, everybody. This is John Starks at Knightley. I'm one of the owners, and today we have Steve Childers from the city of Springfield. Steve, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate having me.
Yeah. And today we wanted to dive right in and talk about a few topics. And Steve, first of all, we want to talk about what's going on in the city of Springfield as it relates to short-term rentals.
Sure. The city of Springfield has had short-term rentals really not that long, I would say, but we do have an established process for short-term rentals. We have about 350 licensed short-term rentals right now in the city. And the process usually goes through the Planning and Development Department, which is the department that I manage. And you have basically three types of short-term rentals. You have your type one, where I am the owner of the house, and I'm going to have another part of my home, and I'm going to rent that out. But I am owner occupying that short-term rental. Then you have a type two, which we see the most of, where I'm an investor and I own a property, and it's a single-family neighborhood, and that is going to be a nightly rental. So we see mostly the type twos. And then you have the type threes, which is we don't see that a lot, but that is where you would be in a multifamily complex and you are using some of those dwelling units as a short-term nightly rental. So those are basically the three types. It's very similar to a lot of other cities around the country.
So if an investor's interested in getting their property permitted as a short-term rental, what are the requirements? What's the process?
Well, the process begins with an application, so it depends on the type, like I said. So we'll probably use type two as the best because that's their most frequent one. I'm an investor, and I buy a property, and I'm either going to rent that out on a monthly basis or maybe I'm going to do nightly rental. So I file an application with the Planning and Zoning Department. That is, I believe, about a $715 fee to pay for everything. And until a few months ago, the process would have been, if you were eligible, you would go through the staff review, then you would go through an investigation or an evaluation by the building department. And if that was found to be suitable, then you would get that approved at the Planning and Zoning Commission. Some things have changed now as of recent with that. And there is the newest and probably biggest thing is that now there is a spacing requirement for short-term rentals where no new short-term rental can be located within 500 feet of another existing short-term rental. So that has definitely changed some things around a bit in the way that we're receiving, you know, applications and requests for new.
So let's talk about that. Number one, I've got kind of two questions. Number one, what if I don't want to pay the $715? Can I just like call up there first and just see if there's something close to mine? And then the second one, with the 500-foot rule, what if there's a hotel that's also allowing nightly stays? Does that encumber my ability as a residential property across the street from being qualified as a short-term rental?
Those are two really good questions, John. I'll answer the first one. Yes, you know, we understand as it was short-term rental or any question that anybody has, the Planning and Development Department, we want to help. We can certainly look up and look at the map. You can go online. There is a map online, and you can see where the existing short-term rentals are, at least the ones that we have business licenses for. Not that there's maybe not some being used for that, but the ones that we know that we've permitted, and you can see that. But no, we're more than happy if you call up and give us an address of where you're looking. We can look that up for you and let you know if there's another one in the distance. The second question is a little bit harder, and I wish I had a definitive answer. I am going to say, I need to look this up myself, you caught me on that one. I'm going to say that the 500-foot rule is applicable regardless of the type that you have. So whether it's a one next to a two or a two next to a three, which you just described, a three would be the hotel scenario or apartment complex scenario. And then I have a single-family dwelling that I'm interested in purchasing and putting a short-term rental in. That 500-foot distance may keep you from doing that. But I certainly want to get back to your listeners and get you that answer. If they have that question, you can tell them online.
Another little nuance that we run into as well in the type 3 category is if we have a building that has multi-units, is there a limit on the number of units that you can have?
Yes, there is. And I'll tell you that differs greatly from city to city and from state to state. In the city of Springfield, it is pretty limited. When they first introduced the ordinance and regulations for managing short-term rentals, the cap that they put for the maximum number of units you can have in a type 3 is 2. So whether you have a fourplex, you can have 2 units as nightly rental, or if you had 100 dwelling units in an apartment building, you can still only have 2 units that are nightly rentals. You can go to some cities, let's say Nashville, for example, and that same guideline doesn't exist, you know. So they're pretty tight on that regulation right now as it comes to the type 3 in the city of Springfield.
You touched on this earlier in one of your responses. What triggers enforcement as it relates to the city? Because you said we have the map, we know the legal ones that are permitted, but there could be these illegal short-term rentals where they're not filing their sales tax or they're not
sure
permitted properly.
You know, usually what happens is we get a call from the neighborhood. So, you know, I'm going to say that it's reactive. And that's great because the best eyes and ears that the city really has are the neighbors. And there are people that live in these neighborhoods. And, it, you know, if it's a well-run, well-managed facility like Nightly would manage, because that's what you do, then clearly there's not likely to be an issue in the neighborhood. But if you have a random individual that's managing that, the ones we see sometimes that have the problems are they're out-of-state owners, or maybe they're out-of-town owners. They're not around. They don't have a property management company doing it for them. I don't know how they do it. Those are the ones that we usually get calls on. It is reactive. We can, and we do. The licensing department does look every year to see which ones are licensed. And we have talked to the vendors, you know, like VRBO and those. And they don't really like to police that. And I don't blame them. I mean, that is something that probably would be pretty tough to do. So if you go online and you see one, and it's booked through one of the online travel agents, you might notice that. And as from a city standpoint, we may look up the business license and realize that it's being advertised, but there's no business license. So you can accidentally find them that way. But again, sometimes it's the neighbor that actually looks that up and says, hey, I know this property is being advertised because I can see it. And I've looked it up and there's no business license. So we learned about it that way.
What does enforcement look like after it's discovered that there's an illegal one? Is it what does the city do?
Yeah, enforcement is typically done by the Building Development Services Department. So we call that BDS. If BDS is notified and they go out and they verify or can identify that it's operating in such a manner that it's not licensed for, then the owner will be identified, and then BDS will notify that owner that, hey, you're in violation of the city section such and such, and it begins right there. How fast does that happen? As soon as we know, we react to it. But like with all city policies or any law, you have to give the violator an opportunity to, you know, remedy the problem. Maybe they just haven't gotten it licensed. Maybe they can go through that process. But here's the trick to anyone who may know of such a situation. If there is a short-term rental that is operating and it is doing so without a business license, then it's not a legally identified short-term rental. So if that is discovered and you are in a situation where, yes, I've been operating this, but now I want to make it legitimate, then you fall under the same 500-foot radius guideline as everyone else. So even though it's been operating, because it wasn't registered, now if there is another one within 500 feet of that, you would not be able to get that registered. So don't do that. Please follow the rules and get it licensed, and you know, make sure you're doing everything by the book. Otherwise, you could find yourself in a situation where you can't continue to operate that.
Great advice. And we advocate for legal short-term rentals.
Sure.
Which brings up kind of another question too. And you mentioned the rules have changed here recently.
Yeah.
The spacing, which begs the question, are there other short-term rentals that were grandfathered in previously that were within that 500 that were already in operation that were permitted legally? So this new rule comes into place. If I'm going to list that home, can I tell in my listing, or can I say, if an investor buys it, you're grandfathered in because the new rule is 500, but we followed the rules and we have two of them within 100 feet of each other, but these are grandfathered in because we did this before the spacing rule.
Yeah.
And you now can buy this and you're okay. Is that,
I think that's the case? That's another great question. I'll answer that kind of in two parts. If you were legally licensed and identified prior to the new 500-foot rule, then yes, you would be grandfathered in. That property would be grandfathered in. The second part of that is if I were to want to sell that as a nightly rental business, then can I do that with the assurance that the new buyer can continue operating that? I want to say that I believe you can, as long as the operation of the nightly rental doesn't cease for a certain period of time. So let's say that you stopped doing it and it was 6 months or 9 months, and then someone came in and said, oh, well, it was a nightly rental before. Well, it was, but it's past the timeline to where it can be considered still an ongoing business where the business license can transfer to a new owner. So I'm sorry that I don't have that exact answer, but I would love to get back to you on that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a gold nugget right there.
It is.
So advice to the listing agents that are out there, tell your investor that owns the home, keep it as a short-term rental while it's listed so that you don't have a gap.
Yes.
And you lose that time so that you can list this as a business because it makes the property worth it.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Your buyer can quickly get that relisted. And now you have that permit. You don't have to go through the permitting process. That's $715 just for the application, right?
Yeah, that's just for the application. So actually, the licensing is a very fairly simple process to do that once you've been approved. So yes, I would say that if you're marketing it, and sometimes I see that. We were just talking before the show about real estate and knowing realtors that send leads to people. And I see leads sometimes that come in that say, hey, nightly rental for sale. Well, as you said, you're going to want to make sure that if I'm buying it for the purpose to continue as a nightly rental, that I can do that as a new owner. Yeah, that's a very good point and very key for people to know out there in the listening world.
So my next question is, how does the city think about short-term rentals? And here's the basis about this. Kansas City is hosting the World Cup. They don't have enough accommodations. Nightly, us, we've been invited to go to Kansas City. They're going to do some temporary relief on short-term rental rules, policies, because they're projecting they don't have enough accommodations. There's just not enough space for people to stay in. How does the city of Springfield think about things like that as it relates to future investment with the city, with growth, with everything else that's happening?
Wow, what a real life situation right in our back door. Kansas City hosting such a big event. We used the Kansas City short-term rental ordinance as a model when the city of Springfield was adopting their very first one. And we use Kansas City as a comparison city quite a bit, especially when it comes to this topic. And so I know a lot about the Kansas City rules. And as you probably know, they have also tightened up their regulations, what I would consider fairly significantly in the last few years. So they may find themselves now in a situation where that's a tough situation and they need to temporarily find a solution to that. I would say that really the city of Springfield is open to discussing this topic more. I don't think that we have ended the discussion on this topic. I think we saw quite a few applications coming in. People saw that as a relatively rapid growth of short-term rentals. They were in neighborhoods where you don't have really an established homeowner association or any other things that can govern that. So it's really just sort of neighborhood, you know, watching over its neighbors and things like that. And it was perceived to be happening a little bit quickly, and that's why the distance requirement was put in place. However, we talk a lot about the growth of the city of Springfield. We talk about new soccer fields and the expansion of MSU and football into Division I, and you talk about civic centers and all these different things, and we know that we're expanding. And so lodging or housing of any kind, whether it be permanent or temporary, is something that we talk about a lot. So if you consider short-term rentals or temporary nightly rentals as part of the housing equation, then I don't know how you leave it out of the conversation. Because one, I think of the reasons why maybe you saw the distance requirement come into play was that some of these houses are being purchased by investors. These people that are traveling are staying there. So that removes a property from being able to be sold or owned or for a resident of Springfield. And that's true. I understand that. It reduces your inventory from that standpoint. But from a different standpoint, where we just need places for people to be, which is the housing situation we're in, just don't have enough units.
What I hear you saying is, just using Kansas City as an example, restricting short-term rentals over a couple of years, bidding for a major event like the World Cup, winning, oops, we don't have enough housing. Where are we going to put all these people?
Yeah.
And then you have the hotel advocacy saying, let's eliminate all these short-term rentals, right? Because we have deep pockets. They don't play by the same rules we do. And then we win this World Cup thing, and now we don't have enough place for people.
You know, and that's one of the criticisms. And I do know the hotel motel lobby is definitely has a staunch opinion on short-term rentals. I understand that. But I think when Springfield made the right move to level the playing field was that we treat short-term rentals from a business license, from a you have to pay your sales tax and submit that. We treat that the same level as we do a hotel room. The hotel motel tax applies to short-term rentals. Now, those people who violate that rule, look, we'll do the best we can to enforce that and define that and to catch them, you know, but it is what it is. People either follow the rules or they don't. But as far as leveling the playing field with the requirements that we have for hotel, motel rooms, as well as paying the same for short-term rentals, that is level in the city of Springfield.
So I got to ask you about, okay, so I can't get it permitted. What if I could get it rezoned as a commercial property and not a residential property? Is that a possibility?
It's a good time to ask me that. That kind of is twofold. If you're in a single family residential neighborhood, getting something rezoned to a commercial zoning would be relatively difficult, if not almost impossible, especially if you were inside the middle or heart of a neighborhood. Maybe if you were on the fringe, maybe if the neighborhood was on the edge of a primary arterial or secondary collector street, something larger, you might be able to do that. But I don't know that it would be any easier. But the city of Springfield, with its new comp plan forward SGF, is also, through my department, writing a brand new zoning code. And we have reduced the number of our zoning districts from over 20 to now in the area of 11. And what that was intended to do was allow for more uses to go into a zoning district. So now what used to be a single family can also be rezoned to RMX1, that is residential mixed, but that's a low level of density. But in the low RMX1, you can have single family all the way up to a fourplex. So, and I want to make sure everybody understands, that doesn't mean we're going to go fill single family neighborhoods with fourplexes. That just means that when it's appropriate, when it's adjacent, if the lot is large enough, if you're on the right street, we call it missing middle housing. And missing middle housing is a new thing that is a phenomenon across
the country because housing, we don't have enough of it, and increasing density in what was traditionally single family zone neighborhoods is something that we're talking about. Kansas City certainly uses it. But as far as how that would work if you had that fourplex, remember, it would be considered a type three, and so you could still only have two units. But that would be 50% of the units that you had. So in a smaller footprint type of scenario versus a large apartment, the type three scenario works with the maximum of two.
Got to ask about, because the city of Springfield has plans for growth, and so I got to ask about annexation. So, you know, as you think about Greene County
yep.
versus the city, so if I have a short-term rental that's outside of the city limits, so it falls outside the jurisdiction.
Right.
So I can now operate it. I'm not having to abide by all these rules and regulations. How does that work? And then what if it's annexed? How does that work?
I think I'm on number three of the, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to get back to you scenario. I can tell you that I just left a meeting with the Springfield Housing and Apartment Association where our new city manager, David Cameron, spoke. And one of the topics that he mentioned was revitalizing and repurposing vacant lots that are sitting around and seeing how we go about that, but also annexation, you know, having a growth strategy. As it pertains to what you just mentioned, having a subdivision that may be outside and then it becomes compact and contiguous, maybe the city has a consent to annex when it does, now it does, and now it's inside the city. Does that mean I can or can't continue to operate my business now that I'm inside? Or is that grandfathered too, as if it's operating this way? I think the city probably has never asked itself that question.
Yeah.
Or at least I haven't heard that question asked just like that. So it's one of the notes I'm going to take back and research a little bit and talk to one of the council committees and make sure that it's something that, hey, when we do this, well, how would you like us to handle this?
I appreciate that. Those are the kinds of questions we get all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, hey, I can't invest here, but what if I went right outside the city line? And then what happens if that area gets annexed?
Mm-hmm.
Then am I out because I made this big investment, or am I allowed to keep doing it, or what's going to happen?
You know,
those kinds of questions we get asked. And so that's why we're so thankful you're here today.
Well, I'm thankful to be a part of it because with the new code, I can tell you that all industries, whether we're working with the engineers or our architects or, you know, our super users of our code, business investors, real estate investors, those are also our customers. And learning these questions that are being asked in each individual industry helps me go back and raise the question and come up with an answer and say, hey, whether it's a one they like or whether it's one they don't, they need to have an answer, because this way at least everyone knows what direction the city is going in or what rule they are going to have in place so that they can make these business decisions without fear, you know, or a great level of risk where, oh my, I've made an investment and now I can't do what I originally intended to do. So having these conversations helped me a lot go back and really have a conversation about maybe something we didn't think about.
That's great. Is there any misnomer or misconception that you'd like us to help clarify as part of this podcast with the investors that are out there, the real estate community?
You know, I think that the biggest thing that maybe leadership and myself want everyone to know is that we want to talk to everyone. We want to make sure we understand the challenges that are occurring out there in business. We have to every day balance business desires with the neighborhood's desires. And that's a tough thing to do. I think you've seen some cases in Springfield where that has become evident. But hey, it's a thing. And we're very engaged with our neighborhoods, but also our business community. So I believe that these conversations are vital to continue to have, because I think that it's the ambiguity that scares people. If we can be more clear about, hey, here's what we allow, here's what we don't, here's how it happens, you have a part in it, and it can be done right if we just follow these rules. I think that always don't be afraid to work with us. You know, we're government, but we're not that scary. So,
Steve, I'm so thankful for you being here today.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
You bet. Yeah. You bet. Anytime.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.